here at the Ashkenaz Festival in Toronto at the Harbourfront with Daniel Kahn. How's it going, Daniel?
Pretty well. Pretty good. It's good to be here. I haven't been in Toronto for a really, really long time, and it's nice to be back.
Good. I hear you just got back from a trip at Montreal, and before that at the Clez Canada camp?
Yeah. I've been at Clez Canada for the last 5 years, so it was good to come back there and see everybody. It's like coming home in many ways.
Okay. There's a good community of people there?
Yeah. I've made a lot of really close friends through my involvement there, and I've learned a lot. It really changed my life, that place.
I'd like to sort of find out how you got oriented towards Yiddish music, klezmer music, starting from your previous music career that was maybe less focused on that.
I don't know. It sort of just grew. It was like some sort of a sickness. You know, I became infected and had an incubation period, and then it's sort of full-blown Yiddish klezmer kite. I don't know. I first encountered klezmer music in New Orleans when I lived there, and I got into it, and I learned how to play some stuff on my accordion. And then it was after I went to Clez Canada that I started to get deeper into the dance music. And then once I moved to Berlin, I fell totally in love with Yiddish song, and I realized that Yiddish was something that I could go further into and learn more about, and it excited me. So I did that. Started singing more Yiddish songs and translating Yiddish songs into English, singing that, and started a band for a number of reasons. And now I'm learning the language actually so I can speak it and read the literature. Mm. So
you're saying you're just in New York studying?
Yeah, I went to the YIVO summer program. So I was living in Michael Alpert's apartment, which is, you know, it's kind of like, living in this amazing treasure trove of not only of Yiddish culture, but, you know, Slavic culture, song culture in general. And he's a good friend, so it was good to be there.
Can you explain for myself and for the listeners who that is?
Michael Alpert is a singer and a musician. He is a member of Brave Old World and has been in countless groups and has traveled the world. He's kind of like Gandalf or Johnny Appleseed of Yiddish song. You know, he's an amazing guy. And he was a major part of the revival. He was in Coppelia back in the 70s. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to sort of get your thoughts on this idea of the klezmer revival. Not idea, reality of the klezmer revival. I guess some people talk about it as after the Holocaust musicians, Jewish musicians sort of not necessarily wanting to play klezmer music and people maybe not necessarily being in a place to hear it or not, I don't know. But either way, people didn't start, I guess, playing it with as much fury and it's not, I guess, as common. So I'd like to get your thoughts maybe on what you think of this idea of a klezmer revival or just the reality of it.
Well, I think this sort of narrative of, you know, Holocaust happened and people decided to not play klezmer music. It's a grossly oversimplified narrative. I think that there's a reason that we talk about revivals in biological terms, you know, in terms of, you know, life processes. It's not a reconstruction. It's, you know, it's a revival. But it wasn't dead. I think that a lot of people saw it as dead, and that led to a lot of creative work, but it actually wasn't dead. Things change, you know. I think that most of the people who played klezmer music in the old world stopped playing it, not because they decided that it wasn't hip anymore, but because they were killed. You know, the destruction of European Jewish culture is probably, it was one of the most successful things that happened in modern history, if that's what the Nazis were trying to do. But the thing about culture is that it doesn't really, it can't be killed. It can't be killed that easily. There's a lot of trauma in it. I think a lot of people dealing with Jewish culture, they have to deal with a trauma. But by no means was it dead, and by no means is it something that we have to completely invent. So I guess I'm inspired by that interplay between a kind of invention and also an investigation of the past. You know, history didn't go anywhere. It's something that Utah Phillips said. He just died this year. He said the past didn't go anywhere. That time isn't some sort of a, it's not static, it's not linear, it's like a river, you know, and we're all standing in the river and it's fed by tributaries, and we can reach into that past and take what we need to move forward. These are his words. So he also said, you know, talk about the past, I can go outside and pick up a stone that's older than the oldest song you know and come in here and drop it on your foot. That's the past. That's Utah Phillips. So I take what he says literally, that we have to look back in order to go forward. I think that the idea that avant-garde art or progressive, so-called progressive art, requires a break with the past is I think that's actually conservative propaganda. I think that we've all been tricked into believing that to move forward we have to be completely obsessed with novelty. And it's this distraction with novelty that has allowed us to lose touch with some of the most important things that we've ever had. Democratic impulses and community impulses, ways of communicating, ways of, you know, methods of conflict resolution that we've completely lost touch with, and the role that culture has in all of those, the role that music has in a society. We've lost touch with all of this because we're too busy looking forward at whatever people are selling us as the future. Siz nit ho kein necht, es noch nit ho der morgen. Siz nich bo a bissl heint, sperrt im nit mit sorgen. Siz nich bo a bissl heint, sperrt im nit mit sorgen. Hey, 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 hey.
Mir sind beim Web, dem Herze Hashem auf jener Welt, wird mir nach nicht geben. Dem Herze Hashem auf jener Welt, wird mir nach nicht geben. Hey, 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 hey. Buried, mourn it on the morrow. Here is but ephemeral bliss, ruin it not with sorrow. So grab yourself a bottle while you still can swallow. You won't cop a single drop in the world to follow. No, you won't cop a single drop in the world to follow. Yeah. exile. That's the way to dance away sorrow in exile.
That Yiddish is a good form of communication for asking questions?
Yeah.
Doing that interrogation that you're talking about?
Well, in some ways, Yiddish itself is a question. Yiddish, I mean, while it has boundaries, what it doesn't have are borders. And I like that about it. I mean, it's a language that developed internationally. It developed across borders. And yeah, that's a turn on for me. It is an oversimplification. Yiddish is many, many things. And I don't want to say that it's just that. It's not just this great anti-nationalist model of, you know, the cosmopolitan new man. It's not that. It's many, many things. One thing that I like about it is that it questions national borders. Another thing that I like about it is that it also is not dead, but it has a precarious place in people's minds. When they hear it, they don't necessarily know how to react to it. And more often than not, when people do have an idea of Yiddish, it's not really what I deliver, you know? Often the people that I piss off the most have some sort of an expectation of what Yiddish song is supposed to be about. But for the most part, I sing Yiddish for people who don't have an idea of Yiddish. Or at least don't have an idea of it being used in the context in which I use it.
You know? Yeah. So I think it's important to at least add that depth to the language. That's something other than just the sort of stripped down few words that you learn growing up in the North American sort of, I guess, mainstream.
Yeah. Yinglish, in the Yinglish. Those are Yinglish words.
And I think it's something that, rather than interrogating and bringing out the life of the culture that was destroyed, in a way I kind of feel that it trivializes it to kind of put it in that sort of Woody Allen type box, I guess, if you can say that.
And, you mean the box that Woody Allen puts it in, or the box people put Woody Allen in? Yeah, I mean, yeah, I know what you mean. In the world of kitsch, nostalgia.
Yeah, nebbish,
the right. Neurotic. Right. I like the German title of Annie Hall, and I love Annie Hall. The German title is Der Stadtneurotiker. The city neurotic. It's called the urban neurotic.
A bit, which literal, is interesting, but
no, but it's not literal because it puts the stress on him.
Right.
His title is about her.
I see.
You know, and in German it's called Der Stadtneurotiker. It's hilarious.
2006, the album that was released is The Broken Tongue.
The Broken Tongue.
With Daniel Kahn and The Painted Bird, which is your band, I imagine.
Yeah, that's the band that I formed in 2005 in Berlin. It's named after the grotesque novel by Jerzy Kaczynski, which was written in the 60s, and I don't recommend it for children. It's been a fluid band. There have been a few members who are constant, pretty much me and Michael Tuttle, and then there have been a sort of a rotating roster of collaborators and friends, now it's, well, the new record has like 13 people on it. But often when we tour, we're about four or five.
On your website, you've got lyrics posted, which is great. both Yiddish and English, which the album is sung in.
There's a German song on that album, too.
Okay. A few things struck me. First of all, the title track, Broken Tongue, I really enjoyed sort of reading through the lyrics. I was wondering if you could break that song down a little bit.
Well, the song is actually two songs. It's one big song that I divided into two songs that are on the record. The other song is Son of Plenty, which is sort of... when I sing the song live, I'll often take a couple of verses from there and stick it in, trade out verses. It was sort of like lack of editing was my problem, so I decided to just do two songs. It's interesting, today at the merchandise kiosk here, a woman who speaks Yiddish, she said, why is it called the broken tongue, not the broken language? Because she saw Dos Tebrachene Loshen, you know, which means the broken language. But, you know, tongue language, it's a double meaning. I guess the broken tongue is... it has to do with this paradox of trying to wrestle with the demons of history by singing songs, which I think is... I mean, it's a paradox that I deal with. And it's not only me singing songs, it's also, you know, everybody in this scene, and also Germans in this scene. They also, they get involved with, on a very deep level, with Yiddish music. And I know that these questions come up with them, too. Like, what does this culture have to do with that past? And what does it mean for us to sing this, this material now? It's a, I mean, so... some of the impetus for the song came out of feelings of discomfort that I had sitting in a klezmer concert in Germany listening to people play happy music. You know, sometimes when I introduce the song, I'll say that there's this Yiddish saying, it's Chasen is azoy via levaya nor mit klezmorim. Like, a wedding is just like a funeral, but with musicians, you know.
This is what I actually got from this track. This idea that lyrically, I kind of feel like it captures a lot of the essence of what I feel about klezmer musically, and that the joyous songs have this hint of sorrow, and the sorrowful songs have this element of joy, and you actually have that lyrically. You say when a kiddush, correct me if I'm wrong, when a kaddish sounds like kiddush, which is kind of it. That sort of summarizes.
Yeah, if a kaddish sounds like kiddush, Well, you got that. That's great.
And maybe that's it. You know, I could kind of imagine if I were sitting in a German club hearing klezmer music that's happy, but not with that kind of sort of other element that's sort of constantly there in the joyful songs, and then I could sense a bit of discomfort in myself. I might be able to empathize with that.
Now you who gather joyfully beneath the festive lights and warm each other soulfully with all of your delight, take not too much comfort in this song. For what you choose to elevate from what is cast below is but the tidal whimsy of the seas you do not know, and may well turn asunder before long. A diamond I have found beneath the snow, buried in the ground, beneath a ruddy mound, beneath a ruddy mound where nothing grows. The guests are almost ready for the dancing to begin. They've come to toast the wedding between Zion and Berlin. So raise a glass up to the bride and groom. But don't confuse the Deutsch with Yiddish, nor the night with day. And if a Kaddish sounds like Kiddish, bow your head and pray. We never step upon the glass too soon. A shame is I, an Oitzer von der Leyen, an Oitzer von der Leyen. Schwalben verschwellen, verkommen tiefen Wellen, und tiefen Wellen. hypocrisy reveals that decadence and revelry can undermine your zeal and turn the prophecy upon its ear. For in the dying embers of a century of blood is all we must remember to avoid the coming flood of prophecies we all refuse to hear. Cannot erase the memory of bells already rung, nor can it unring the ones we hear. So let the broken birds return upon their painted wings, and let the broken words be burned unto the songs we sing, till every note is new unto our ear.
This is probably what drew me to the music in the first place. You know, like, I like sad songs, man. A song with no darkness in it depresses me. You know, the music that I really, really love, it's full of darkness. Not full, but there is no hope without acknowledgement of despair. You know?
I think it's part of soul music.
Absolutely, it's because it's in the blues. It's in the blues, and it's in gospel and soul music. So that means that it's written into the music, it's written into the idiom of music that I so love in American pop music and in folk music and in punk rock and in jazz, you know, is this presence of death, you know, or what, you know, Neruda used to talk about and Lorca, the duende, you know, this awareness of death, of his presence. And so, yeah, what you're talking, this sadness and joy, it's the essence of everything. You know? It's what Shostakovich talked about in Jewish music that so drew him to it. It was this, that it operates on two levels.
Geographically also, my next question was leading to New Orleans, which I know you lived there for some time, and if I could think of any music that strikes me as having that similar characteristic, it's sort of jazz and music from New Orleans, soul music out of New Orleans. I mean, you can just even listen to their funeral processions, and you can feel that. I think.
Well, later, have you heard our New Orleans song?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna play that later on tonight.
Song, yeah,
and because that's, I actually think that it's. That's the one thing I miss in Jewish music is the absence of funeral music. And I kind of like, you know, if there's... I want to fill that absence with New Orleans second line jazz funeral music. So that's why we do this song about the Titanic that we changed over into being a song about New Orleans. We only changed about four of the words in the Yiddish to make it about New Orleans and Katrina. And then I did an English version, and we play that as a second line. And I mean, of course, we want to play it tonight because my friends, you know, in New Orleans, all the folks down there, they're facing a scary situation right now with Hurricane Gustav. So,
do you know anything about the housing situation in New Orleans now?
Those neighborhoods in the Lower Ninth Ward are being rezoned as industrial parks. These people have been absolutely screwed. Which is nothing new. These problems did not start with Katrina. They started a long time ago. Nobody fixed them before Katrina, and it became a catastrophe. My friend Mark Rubin's here. He lives in Austin, and he's got people staying there right now. I mean, you know, people aren't stupid. They're leaving this time. And they weren't stupid the last time either. What they were neglected.
Yeah.
There were broken promises. And It's a bill that the Republican administration never paid, and they're continuing to not pay it, and they're hoping to get reelected so they can continue to not pay it. So, yeah, I'm pissed off about that, you know. And I don't see the point. I mean, this is just my thing. Like, it's nice to sing songs about, you know, the Warsaw Ghetto and all of this, and to sing songs about the past. But I'm not interested. Actually, if I sing about the Warsaw Ghetto, I'm singing about something today. I don't sing songs that don't have any kind of a relevance to me today, you know. I don't have a problem with the Russian Tsar. I have a problem with, well, I guess, you know, the new Russian Tsar and the American Tsar, you know, and the recurrence of Tsars, you know?
Yeah.
Past didn't go anywhere. So, yeah, New Orleans. Chorb New Orleans.
What does that mean?
Destruction New Orleans. Chorb der Chorb.
Und gewiss, liebe Menschen, gehört, was in New Orleans hat sich verlaufen. Amerikaner Stadt hat sich übergekehrt. Und viele Menschen sind in der Trunken geworden. Stellt euch vor, liebe Menschen, dem Churben, wie groß ist gewesen Gott so, wenn viel Wasser ist rein in die Burben, in die Gassen ist alles verloschen geworden. Ei, 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 ei. Sind in sich gesessen in Frieden. Seine Freude hat doch keiner nicht gestört. Sie haben geschwiegen, lieber Gott, was tust du uns zu schäden? Aber der Präsident hat sich zu sehen nicht zu gehört. Euch stellt euch vor, liebe Menschen, dem Churben, wie groß ist gewesen Gottes Zorn, wenn viel Wasser ist rein in die Kurben und in die Gassen ist alles verloschen geworden. Hey, hey, hey.
Now to the lower Nile War. I, lovers.
They are peacefully lying in a peace not a soul could disturb. Well, they cried out, my dear God, we are dying. But the president seems not to have heard. Well, just imagine, good people, the ruin of the ones that we choose to ignore. With the water from the lake down to Bourbon, from Canal to the Lower Ninth Ward, I said all my life. Ay, 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 ay,
oppressed people have to deal with when their identity is not in line with sort of dominant group is first of all to be able to assert their identity and not sort of face assimilation or other threats. But at the same time, I think it's a onus that's on those communities and not on the sort of dominant community. But then there's always the concern about that identity that's being asserted. Is it being essentialized? Are we putting ourselves, and I'm not speaking as Jews now, are we putting ourselves in a box? But also it's something perhaps we can never get out of, because people from without will perhaps always regard us that way. But at the same time, it's maybe something that's also being done. And I guess here we're at the Ashkenaz Festival now. And I think as we've spoken about, it's really... there's a lot of value and importance in asserting various kinds of challenging and exciting elements of Yiddish culture. But at the same time, I think, especially in North America, there's an essentializing of Jewish identity to Ashkenaz culture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, if you had a festival called Ashkenaz in Israel, you would piss off a lot of people, and rightly so, you know? It's a tricky thing. It's an age-old paradox, the paradox of essentialism in Jewishness. You know, you have what you call Das Pintel Yid, you know, which was this idea that there's a physical point inside of your body that is the thing that makes you a Jew. On the other hand, if you convert to Judaism, you get one of these. You know, like, this is how it was worked out, Talmudic, or, you know, I'm not an expert on these things, but, you know, so this is transmutable essentialism. And there's a paradox there. Generally, I like to what I do is against essentialism, you know. And generally, I got into Yiddishkeit because it was a, like a lot of people, it's a way of being Jewish that was outside of the bounds of what I was handed, of what I received as a kind of prepackaged mainstream Jewish identity when I was a kid. And you run into a lot of tricky situations, especially when it comes to politics. You know, I don't think that there is a necessary politics to being into Yiddish or being a Yiddishist. That is one of the only languages that has an ism attached to it. You know, we have a couple songs on our new record. The new record's called Partisans and Parasites. And we have a couple songs that I'm not going to play tonight. Because it wouldn't, I don't know how well it would go over. I mean, I played one of the songs at Klez Canada, and they almost had my head. They got really pissed off. Not everybody, but a few people. Really, really, really angry. Screaming, swearing at me, trying to pull the power on the plugs. It was like singing Maggie's Farm at Newport. It was insane. People running around. And there was a lot of yelling and a lot of fighting and a lot of upset people, and I thought that that was it for me in this community. And then something really interesting happened. I went to them, to the people who I really pissed off, and we sat down and we talked with one guy, the guy who was most angry. We talked for like 2-3 hours. And he came to, I don't agree with him. He doesn't agree with me. But we had a really, really great discussion, and he came to understand where I was coming from. And I always thought that there was this thing about provoking people and offending them, that if you provoke them, it encourages questioning and discussion, but if you offend them, then it shuts it down and they stop thinking and stop asking and talking. And in this case, I provoked some people, and they responded well. And I really offended some people, and they responded horribly. But it was those people who I was able to eventually really connect with. So even when people are offended, if you can keep them in the room, if you can reach out to them, and it was a lot of work and it made me really tired, it ended up being a good thing. And this was a song that, you know, people could lose, you know, it's not even that radical of a song. But it mentions the P word, you know, it mentions Palestine, and which is probably the most radical thing that it does. Yeah. So, there is that. But if anything is going to kill us, it's going to be not having room for discussion. Yeah. It's going to be a Denkverbot. You know? I don't know what you call that, a thought. It's a verbot, forbiddance. Yeah. You know? I don't know. There's great brass band going on.
Yeah, why don't you come back on the show and we will talk about the P word freely and openly. And
I would love to.
And we can send it on the podcast. We can talk about P and podcast it if you'd like.
Podcasting
the P word.
Absolutely. No, I mean, in the great irony of it is that it's a song that I wrote in Israel that every Israeli I've played it for, including right-wing ones, love the song, even if they disagree with it. You know, but in Israel, you can talk about anything. But there are certain communities elsewhere where they don't want to talk about it. But that's okay. That's changing. Everything's changing.
Right on.
So, yeah.
Let's go enjoy the band. We're
going
to hear Consonance Retro.
Consonance Retro.
Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Yeah, man, it was a pleasure. I loved your...